Talk given Saturday, 1st January 1972. During the last 2 months, we have tried to understand deeply the meaning of pure mind and of psyche, and the very important, the crucial position of the human psyche. And you may recall that we saw that psyche has its roots in the physical body, and the word physical means natural, and it is the result of the interaction of this transcendent energy, pure mind, which is of the nature of eternity, immortality, immeasurability, the interaction of this with the body, which belongs to time, procedure, decay and death. Now we also saw that we here as we are subject to two main forces affecting the psyche. One belongs to the animal realm. The drive for self-preservation and the preservation of the species. And all the qualities, the psychical qualities and activities associated with those two drives, which belong to the animal part of us. And there is that other, which is not a drive, not a pull, which really is indescribable, that power of transcendence, which is embodied, I should rather say embedded through and through the whole psychophysical organism. And the law of the organism, because of its animal evolution, is the law of the animal of the jungle, and the law of pure mind is the law of the spirit, the transcendent law. And we are subject, we are affected by these two main forces. It is very important to understand this very clearly and to be aware of the forces as forces, not only to be conscious of them descriptively. We use words and say the law of the animal, the law of the jungle. Having said the words, the brain ticks it off as, well, that's done with now. But that's no use. In terms of discriminative consciousness, we have merely kept ourselves apart from the reality which those words try to indicate. When we understand their real meaning, then we have become that meaning. there is no necessity for us to examine the meaning as something apart from ourselves. Then we have really understood. There is no confusion. Then there is real awareness. Then we really know this is so. There's no question about it. And you will find that when we emerge into that state of this is so, we cease to describe it. We don't need to describe it. Because the words are always a screen between us, ourselves, the living persons, and the living reality. Now, it is easier for us to understand the part with which we are familiar in our everyday life, the animal part. It is not quite so easy to understand the transcendent part. And the full understanding of the transcendent part means that oneself has really become that transcendence. Not because oneself, through one's own efforts, has grown into something which was seen in a vision beforehand or was predetermined, but because one has so understood and is so awake to all that obstructs transcendence, that in that awareness, in that intense awareness and attentiveness, the obstructions disappear. And then transcendence functions and works through the psychophysical organism. It doesn't need any knowing in the ordinary sense of the knowing subject coming to know an external observed object. See, one may repeat this again and again, and one may say, yes, I've heard that before, I've got it. What have I got? Nothing at all. If I've got it, it is something different, separate from me. Isn't that so? If I've got transcendence, if I were so absurd as to say such a thing, I possess transcendence in my pocket, which obviously is absurd. All that can happen is that this obstructiveness of the isolative self-consciousness can be so out of the way, one can be so healed of that illness, that transcendence is here within the living organism, unobstructed. We get the idea, but we have to go right beyond the idea. To give rather a crude physical analogy, it is as if we are always with the banana skin in our hands, but the banana falls away and is lost. It's not that. It's the real thing. The analogy fails hopelessly, because whereas with transcendence gets you, you get and eat the banana and throw away the skin. It goes upside down, so to say. So now, with regard to emerging into this state of realization, we must become intensely aware of the obstructive factors. As you know, we are the creatures of our conditioning. Our animal heritage as well as our socio-cultural heritage. And this socio-cultural heritage conditions the psyche so very strongly that this power of pure mind in us gets locked up, imprisoned by it. If pure mind functioned freely without being obstructed, we would be constantly intelligent in the true sense of the term. That means constantly able to perceive the truth of that which is actually present without making any error. Our insight would be perfect insight all the time, everywhere. But the psyche is so strongly conditioned, and our speech faculty and technique is so strong that it is always the external shape, the description, the unreal, which is uppermost in our consciousness. And the inward reality, which that description is supposed to convey, we are blind to that. This is our difficulty. This power of awareness, this which has been called, particularly in India, absolute consciousness, pure consciousness, the one without a second, and so forth. This consciousness is something which we don't know, which we are not. It is this which has to find release and perfect expression through the psychophysical organism, which is ourself. It's very easy to feel, oh yes, now at last I've got that. I've really seen it. I had a real inspiration this morning or whatever it was, and now I really know. This is an illusion. The real knowing always is actual being. He who really knows God is God. He who really knows truth in the spiritual transcendent sense is himself the truth. When Sri Krishna, Jesus, Al-Halaj, the Sufi mystic who was martyred, said, I am the truth. They knew what they were saying. They were the truth. The truth which cannot be given over, parceled out to another. The truth which is being. Now the truth which is being is always indescribable. And why is it indescribable? Because all description is in the terms of sense functioning. We utilize all our accumulated knowledge through the use of our sight, our hearing, our touch, and then our talking, which we call thinking, our emotions, our feelings, and all the rest of it. We utilize all that material in order to describe. And all that has validity within the restricted sphere of the ambivalent, of duality, of multiplicity, in which there is the whole of the becoming process. But this is mortal. This is measurable. That other which is immortal, immeasurable, in which all this mortal and measurable is completely subsumed, that is completely beyond all descriptive processes. You see, we talk day and night. Literally, day and night. We talk in our sleep. Not loudly, but we keep on talking. The good old encephalographs reveal a good deal. We go on talking all the time. But we don't realize. We are not really awake to the fact that all this is about that which is born and dies only. Samsara. That which begins, proceeds, finishes, which is born, which decays, suffers, dies. So all our descriptive activities are confined to this realm of death, the prince of this world, the lord of death, is the supreme one in the realm of multiplicity. But there is that which is other than death. And that which is other than death is this itself here, which because of our descriptive activity and discriminative consciousness, we are aware of only as a becoming process and death. There is no separate, different world, which is the realm of God or transcendence or immortality or eternity. It is this. The difficulty is in my psychophysical being. This psychophysical organism is an instrument, a vehicle, which is still incapable of experiencing and realizing that change by which the immeasurable, the eternal, is freely manifest through this perishable psychophysical organism. This is why it is ultimately always a matter of the transformation of one's mode of awareness of existence. Reality, truth, is only one. One whole absolute. Whatever it is. But this living being called a human being is aware, is conscious in such limited terms that that oneness, that wholeness is only a thing in the distance, a thing of desire, a thing of aspiration, an ideal. And whatsoever is a thing of aspiration, an ideal, a desire, is an obstruction to transcendence. Because every ideal and every aspiration and every desire is a limited something, a finite something, therefore belonging to death. And it drives us, it moves us to the objective, which itself is a limited finite thing, which is a thing of death. If my objective is God, I could find that God, and in the moment of the finding, he will be dead. He will be not wanted. What happens whenever we have satisfied our passion? We turn away from the object of passion. Supposing one is gifted as a musician, a violinist will want to possess a Stradivarius or any of the most marvelous violins of the world. And his whole energy will go into grasping that, into obtaining it. When he has obtained it, his whole energy flops down and he turns away from it. He values the instrument, he utilizes it, but in that process he's constantly going to it and turning away from it. You see, it is the realm of duality. It is the birth-death realm. It is the joy-sorrow, pain-pleasure realm. It is the realm of the unsatisfactory. As some schools of Buddhism would present it. But transcendence you never go to, you never turn away from. Is there anything you and I have realized in our own life, in our own living experience, which was of such a nature that we never went to it and never turned away from it, but it was there everlastingly? Is there anything? The omnipresent, the indescribable, the ungraspable, the thing which is not of desire and therefore the barb of disappointment and grief, is there? Yes, there is. Space. Space, the absolutely undeniable, the unknowable, ungraspable. The thing which is without finitude. Insubstantial, out of which miraculously comes out substance, which you and I can experience through the senses. And just as space is this transcendent origin of matter, there is also transcendent origin of consciousness, pure consciousness itself. And it is in man, this creature man on this planet, through whom this is emerging. This is the purpose of our existence. The supreme and the religious purpose of our existence. So you see, if one is at least intellectually strongly aware of that as a fact, then it becomes easy, relatively easy, to see all our conditioning. And where do we see our conditioning? And how do we see it? Only in our daily experience, from moment to moment. That which actually is present. Now the important point here is not so much the external physical material, the room, the chairs, the tea, the meeting, the performance, the office, the typewriter, etc. It's not merely that. And all the activities that we go through, eating, drinking, sleeping, and all the rest of it. It's not merely that. It is what happens in here, inside our own brains, inside our own minds, all the time, in relationship to that. Otherwise, we will inevitably have the wrong attitude towards our external conditioning. Why will we have the wrong attitude towards our external conditioning? Because seeing the external shape of things around us, and you know how true this is, we are all cussed enough to want it to be different. No, I don't want it that way, I want it this way. Then your husband or wife or father or brother or friend, somebody comes, oh no, don't do it like that, do it like this. And then some clever writer, you see, just observes all this fiddle-faddle which goes on between human beings, writes novels, plays, and there we are. Churning up the stuff of existence. You see, we get driven by desire. And the shape our desire takes is the index of all our conditioning. One may say, oh, but you are born that way, with such and such ductless glands and this sort of physical structure, and therefore you behave like that. Of course. Therefore you behave like that. But that precisely is my physical conditioning. My natural physical heritage, the animal heritage in me. You see? It is my conditioning. In addition to that is the conditioning from the time I was born, of all that was said, that was done by those around me. Together with the books and the customary practices, the behavior, customary action, morality. Morality simply means customary action, according to the customs, mores, Latin mores. The customs of the people. And morality is customary action, customary behavior. So you see, I will be driven by desire. My desire is shaped by all this. If I pay attention only to the external shape of what is, but the immediate reactions to the what is that rise up within me, the organism, these are the things which I must be really awake to and attend to. Attend with pure attention, not with impure attention. We attend with impure attention. Krishnamurti said, attentiveness is so important. Firoz also says the same thing. Somebody else says this and somebody else says that. Oh yes, now I must attend because, you see, thereby the millennium will dawn for me. All my problems will vanish away and the garden will become full of roses without thorns. And the ponds will be all milk and with a little bit of honey inside. No. That is impure attention. That is the devil in me attending. Just attend. Desirelessly mindful. And in the attempt, the effort, in the giving of all your energy towards this desireless mindfulness, up will come all the secret hidden desires. You will know yourself as no external psychoanalyst can help you to know yourself. So you see, when you attend in that manner, you are attending purely. As these things come up, you see your own impure mindfulness. In the very seeing, you are free of the impurity. You cannot acquire purity. You cannot acquire the transcendent spiritual virtues and values. Virtue, in its transcendent reality, is you yourself. There is nothing to acquire. You have to be free of the ambivalent virtue-vice conflict. The result is virtue, just natural virtue. So you see, there comes pure attentiveness. It comes slowly. But when it functions, when it has really functioned, its effect is immediate. It completely transforms the impure state into the pure state. And you're free of it. You are free of it because you don't get free of an impure state. Because that can easily be replaced by another impure state. You see? But this dualistic conflict in our ambivalently functioning psychical life, this dualistic conflict for once and for all gets resolved. I can't resolve it by desiring it, by any technique or anything. If I attend purely, then the resolution takes place. Some things happen. Goodness knows what. But it happens. And that's that. And you're free. So you see, we who are creatures of conditioning and of desire, with our conditioning and our desire, want to find God, to realize perfection, and all the rest of it. Once we see the futility of it, the falsity of our approach, the mistaken approach we make, it will inevitably land us into fresh sorrow and difficulty. Once we see that, we cease to struggle in the wrong way. It is as if you are, as indeed you are at the moment, in 9 Westbourne Drive. And you're struggling away, going here, going there in the house in order to find out where is 9 Westbourne Drive. It's here, you're in it. Just be quiet, sit down, enjoy yourself. It's as simple as that. But it is as difficult as that. The simplest things are the most difficult. I first learned that lesson with tribulation when I tried to learn a simple Bach fugue. The fugue is simplicity itself, but I happen to be one of those people who finds it extremely difficult to play contrapuntal music on a piano. My brain follows it, my fingers won't do it somehow. They are very rebellious. So I discovered that here is a thing so simple. When my teacher used to play it for me, oh, it was just obvious. Well, of course it is that. No question about it. When I tried to do it, it never was that. Simple, but very difficult. Now look, there's just one other point I'd like to talk about. Because we've been dealing with rich stuff these last 40 minutes. We talk about attending to the now. The perfected Holy One, the realized being, is one who is completely attentive in the now. The eternal now, which is carried as the eternal now through time. Have you ever watched yourself trying to attend to the now? People ask for the method to reach the goal, to become pure, to become holy. There is not a method. But if method means total being, then there is method. Now, have you watched what happens when you attempt to attend to the now? Rarely attend to it. You will find all sorts of fantasies starting up. Because the sense impressions caused by what actually is present in the now, the sights, the sounds, the touches, the smells, and everything, you see, start up. The accumulated sense impressions, which have accumulated in what modern psychology we call our personal unconscious. What in India, in the Upanishads, this is not new knowledge, this is at least 3,000 years old. You'll find it in the Upanishads through and through. The vasanas, the sense impressions, the mental impressions, they all start up and come up and interfere with attending to the now. One of the supreme signs that you are actually fully attending to the now is that if you do attend in that manner, utterly purely, you will find that there is no descriptive process going on as a result of your attention. No descriptive activity is going on. There is a pure cognitive activity, completely devoid of a recognitive activity. If there is this kind of pure cognitive activity, devoid of the recognitive activity, this cognitive activity is free of the effects of memory, of all frustrations, of all desires, and so forth. It is utterly free of that. It is pure cognition which moves unimpeded through every single moment of time. And therefore, time no longer binds you, but you are eternally live, alive in that movement of the now through time. When this happens, you have really experienced being that which you are attending to. Awareness and being have found their identity. This is the holy state. It is the whole state. There is nothing interfering, interrupting, besmirching the perfection of the now. The absoluteness of God here. Nothing to besmirch it. When you attempt to attend purely, as I say, you will find that all the memories, the fantasies will all come up. And you will find that they are always our frustrations or our fulfillments of the past. But the whole of the past is a mummified thing in memory. These congealed ghosts of the past, carried about in our consciousness, prevent us from complete attention and pure attention. A decaying corpse does not give you the same kind of experience that a garden full of roses in bloom gives you. There is a difference between a perfume and a stench. You see what it means to be in the holy state. This state which is which is there when this turning about in the innermost seat of consciousness has taken place. If you just sort of hold yourself in readiness quietly, in readiness, not expectancy. If you hold yourself in readiness inwardly, you will be utterly quiet. You will be utterly still. What will be quiet and still? Awareness. Consciousness, the absolute consciousness, which is divine consciousness, that will be utterly quiet and still. With a quietness and stillness that permeates through and through all the noise of the becoming process. Instead of using the word noise, I'll use the word sound. All the sound of the becoming process. And the sound of the becoming process is made up of the agreeable sounds and the disagreeable sounds. Underneath it, through it all, is this transcendent reality. The peace of God which passes all understanding. Passes all understanding. So this is the pure state, isn't it? Do you have to acquire purity? All effort at acquisition is a struggle, is a disturbance. It inevitably entails conflict. And this belongs to the realm of death, the realm of the ill, dukkha. To use the Buddhist word in its supreme sense. But this pure attentiveness in the now, undisturbed by the uprising of all this dead past, this means that the psyche, and the psyche is so essential and important for us humans, the psyche is cleansed and purified altogether. Haven't you experienced a sense of peace and calm? A sense of blessing, benediction in the presence of someone who has himself or herself seen, and still more so, still more intensely, if he has become the Holy One, become the truth. I am the way, the truth, the life. The great teachers said that, so many of them, not just two or three. Haven't you experienced that? And if that has not been experienced in the presence of a human being, have we not experienced something like that when in those marvelous bestowals of grace through music, through the beauty of nature, through something quite insignificant in itself, a little baby smile or something like that, you happened to be so utterly quiet and in a state of harmony that transcendence suddenly blazed through you and spread a light in the place where you were standing. This is one of the meanings, perhaps, of those statements which we have in the scriptures, and the angel of the Lord passed by, spreading his light. You have it in the Hindu-Buddhist form in connection with the devas appearing and lighting up the whole woodland. These are just symbolic forms, meaningful myths. But you, the living person, are the meaning of that myth. So then, attend to the now. The immediate now. You want the method. All right, here it is. Attend to the immediate now. Always, all the time. Now, if we do that, will we be wayward? Will it be possible to be wayward and stray into the dark ways of planning the fulfillment of desires which arise through any and every stimulus? We won't. Because this way is planning to satisfy our desires is the way of ill, the way of sorrow. It is, in a sense, in a deep sense, the sin against the Holy Ghost. As put in Christian terms. Because what is it that the Holy Ghost wants of us, so to say? That we shall be open vessels, pure and clean, through which the power of transcendent mind can work through. So you see, if we are free of planning, scheming, and working for the fulfillment of our own desires, whatever they may be, we will also be free of an extraordinarily tremendous burden of anxiety and fear and misery in our ordinary personal lives. The ignorant one trying to be clever with us will say, "Ah, so you sort of give up the ghost and don't care." The man who says that has not begun to understand the true meaning of caring. That's why he says that. When one is in that pure state, one knows what it means to care. How did the Buddha express that? In words which are, whose very limited meaning only is understood by the conventional Buddhist world. The Buddha said, "Whatsoever a teacher, out of compassion, can do for his disciples, that I have done for you. Go ye and do likewise unto others." And if you look in St. John's Gospel, that wonderful last prayer, if you like, of Jesus by himself in the aloneness, in chapter 17, I think, of St. John's Gospel. Look at that very, very carefully, sentence by sentence, word by word, and see how the divine caring is expressed. How utterly free it is of all personal desire or will. Time and again, Jesus said to his disciples, "Whatsoever my Father tells me, I tell you and give unto you. It is not mine, but the Father's." You see what purity means? There's your secret. Attend purely, completely to the immediate now and see how everything happens. And you, the psychophysical organism, are led into fulfillment. You are returned to your original home, your original Garden of Eden, as transcendence functions freely and unobstructedly through you yourself.